The Song of Solomon is not for the faint of heart. It is filled with provocative imagery and language, and several passages are especially difficult to interpret. One of those we land on tonight in the Lord's good providence. The genre of the book is poetry that has its own attendant difficulties. The subject is the intimate relationship between the king and his bride, and I've suggested to you we should read this on more than one level. We should see this as not only the relationship between a king and his bride, but pointing forward and foreshadowing greater realities. In other words, in keeping with how people throughout church history, for the majority of such interpretations at least, have taken the book, we should see it as pointing to Christ and the church. Not just God in Israel, as was the case in the Old Testament interpretations by Jews. But in Christ, we see this book contributing to messianic hope. The whole Old Testament, as one of my mentors once said, is a messianic document to sustain a messianic hope. And that's what Genesis to Malachi is meant to do in the Old Testament. The Song of Solomon is a way to sustain messianic hope. One of the ways it points toward that is through the covenant of marriage. This matters because in the Old Testament, outside the Song of Solomon, marriage does surface as a parable of sorts of God and his people. And therefore, the marriage between this son of David and the bride invites us to consider these larger themes. And so we want to think about human marriage. We want to think about sexuality and intimacy as the book suggests. But I think there is more here, as we would want to find as well in other books of the Old Testament. The structure of the book is also challenging, in addition to interpretations. But I am proposing that we see the 8-chapter book as what is known as a chiasm, which is a funky literary word of matching sections. I have on the board tonight, on the right side of the board, what this chiasm would look like. It's an arrangement that the outer portions form a frame, and then the portions next to last, in each case, have matching elements. And then there is a centered aspect to the book. Some literary structures can be quite complex. The way that we're not helped, unfortunately, is with chapter divisions. The chapter divisions are all over the place. And I would apologize, but I didn't do it. So they were added in the Middle Ages to help us. So while we can get to actual verses, by splitting the chapter divisions where we are, it looks awfully complicated. I don't mean it to be. That's just the way the chapter divisions are. So we are severely limited in terms of accuracy. But the reason I'm putting this before us tonight is because this particular breakdown of the book, which I'm convinced is the case thus far, I may change my mind in the next couple weeks, we'll see. This is what I think is right. That chapter 1:1 to 2:7 has matching elements to chapter 8:5 to 14. And the chapter we're going to look at tonight, or multiple parts of the book, 5:2 to 8:4, we will break down into 2 weeks. It's simply too large of a chunk to handle. So what we're starting tonight is this fourth of the fifth sections of the book. But there are matching elements. Notice that it is parallel to what lies above it, 2:8 to 3:5. And you might ask, and reasonably so, why is it parallel? What sorts of things will we find in the passage tonight and in next week, since we're taking 5:2 to 8:4 in 2 weeks because of the length? What's matching with 2:8 to 3:5? Here is some help for us, and we'll see the beauty of the song. Both sections, 2:8 to 3:5 and 5:2 to 8:4, contain searching at night. Okay, this is one of the elements. This is not found in any other section of the book, but only in these two sections. And it is significant because each time the search commences, it will eventually end with the reunion of the couple. That happens in 2:8 to 3:5 and in 5:2 to 8:4. But it gets better than that. That's an important theme, and that enough would be, I think, a correspondence worth noting. However, there's also language in each of these sections about the beloved coming to a house. You see this in 2:8 to 3:5. You see this again in 5:2 to 8:4. And it's not clearly stated in any other section of the book. But it gets even more explicit. There's an invitation by the man in the first section, 2:8 to 3:5, to come away. Comes to her house and he says, come away. And 5:2 to 8:4, we see an invitation later in this section from the woman to the man, come away. But it gets even more interesting. In each of these sections, there's an encounter with figures known as the watchman. Now, the encounters don't have the same detail in every respect. In fact, there's some aspects of the encounter with the watchman tonight that are actually alarming. We wonder, interpretively speaking, how to handle those verses. But nonetheless, the watchmen do not appear elsewhere in the book. They appear in these two large sections. Let me give you two more examples of correspondences. In each of these sections, there is a mutual there is a declaration of my beloved is mine and I am his. For example, in chapter 2:16, my beloved is mine and I am his. So that's in that upper section of 2:8 to 3:5. It's in chapter 2:16. And there is another example in our passage tonight of chapter 6, verse 3. I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. Notice the language there and how it's reversed. Earlier in chapter 2:8 to 3:5, there was this little statement of I am my beloved's and my beloved. I'm sorry. He says in chapter 2, verse 16, my beloved is mine and I am his. And then later, I am my beloved's and he is mine. So it's worded a little bit differently, but the correspondence is evident. You don't see that kind of language fully stated elsewhere in the book, just parts of it. One last element. There is language in chapter 2:8 to 3:5 about rising, about arising, like in chapter 2:10, arise, my love. Chapter 2:13, arise, my love. And in chapter 3, verse 2, I will rise now and go about the city. The only other place in the book where rising language happens outside of that section 2:8 to 3:5 is in 5:2 to 8:4, where she says in 5:5, I arose to open to my beloved. So there are themes, there are statements, there are even verbs that exclusively occur in these two sections. There may be more correspondences. That's just a handful of them. The reason it's important to note things like this isn't because we want to make something that's already difficult, like the Song of Solomon, even more complicated. We want to say, this is a beautiful book. This has been thoughtfully, artfully arranged. And so, you know, if I didn't have my notes here, I might not be able to articulate all of those particular correspondences. And that's not the point. The point is, in observing them, we're able to see that there is an arrangement worthy of our attention. Now, in 2:8 to 3:5 and in 5:2 to 8:4, those two sections that I have squared on the board, they are framing a middle section, aren't they? In chapter 3:6 to 5:1, the last time we were together at the end of October, we noted that this is the wedding most explicitly portrayed and narrated, and the wedding night. There are allusions to their intimacy and flashbacks to their courtship earlier, but this is the most thorough treatment, and it also provides for us the first lengthy description of the body of one of the spouses. That happens four times in the Song of Solomon, and the first is encountered there in 3:6 to 5:1. So I think we should notice that it's important that what has been centered is the explicit and lengthy narration of their wedding and their commitment to one another and their mutual desire and the consummation on the wedding night. It makes sense that given the Song of Solomon's purpose, that would be something actually showcased with literary artistry. Let me give you a couple other notes here about some themes. Since it's been a few weeks since we've been in the book, there is this recurring motif that we've seen a few times of the couple being separated and then coming back together, and that coming together involves covenantal commitment language, like in marriage, and then it involves the consummation of their relationship. That has occurred in the first section of 1:1 to 2:7. It occurred in 2:8 to 3:5. It occurred in 3:6 to 5:1, and it's going to happen again in 5:2 to 8:4. So what 5:2 to 8:4 are doing, it's this lengthy section of the couple experiencing some sort of separation and then coming back together. We just have to wait even longer for it to fully realize from when the separation happens to the end of the section. It's a lengthy part. Again, that's why we're taking two Sunday nights to do it. And then we'll see other elements in 8:5 to 14. So there are themes throughout the Song of Solomon of this couple wanting and desiring one another. There are flashbacks to their courtship and themes of separation that are then overcome in the covenant of marriage and in their mutual desire together. All of this is couched in language taking us to multiple parts of the Old Testament. They will describe one another in tabernacle language, temple language, promised land language, Garden of Eden language, so that this couple that is enjoying the fruits of their intimacy in marriage It is if they are going into Eden naked and unashamed like our first parents in Genesis chapter 2. Now, this isn't Adam and Eve, but it is a kind of Adam, and she is a kind of Eve. They're depicted with garden language, and they are enjoying one another in covenant. We are meant, I think, to have our senses just going off all over the place with thinking, that sounds like this part of the Bible. That sounds like the temple. That sounds like the tabernacle. And we have a son of David in covenant with his bride, and the language takes us to multiple parts of Genesis that are full of hope about the very presence of God. I don't think in any way this book is encouraging the idolizing of a spouse. I don't think he's saying she's God to me, or he's saying, or she's saying he's God to her. I think this is language that's meant to evoke, though, the beauty and glories of the intimacy of marriage. And that is what we see again starting in 5:2 to 8:4 tonight. So what we're going to see in our section from 5:2 to 6:3, just part of it, the bride's search, and then she's going to, in verse 9, get some questions from these supporting characters in the book. They're known as the daughters of Jerusalem. Then the bride is going to answer in verses 10 to 16 their questions. Then they're going to have some more for her. They're not satisfied. They have a few other things to ask. In 6:1, you're going to see some more questions and then her answer in 6:2 to 3. So the first thing to note is that there's very little appearance of the man in the whole section tonight. He appears at the beginning of the 5:2 and following, but then he disappears until the very end of our section. Primarily, this passage tonight is about the woman's search and having to dialogue with these supporting characters, the daughters of Jerusalem. It is helpful to remember, though, friends, that this is poetic imagery. Not every verse here, we're meant to try and find some corresponding event in the life of Solomon. He is depicting a love relationship, perhaps even an idealized version of himself with this bride, and he's depicting it in poetry. And sometimes the images are meant to just evoke things, to produce feelings, to move the reader, to leave the reader in awe, but isn't meant to say, okay, so this might have been, if they were to check her diary, you know, at this particular part in Solomon's reign, this is what happened to her. Some of the images here are not meant to be overpressed, and I'm going to identify a few of those in a moment. So here we have, in chapter 5, 2 through 8, the bride's search. And it reminds us, in the corresponding matching section in the chiasm of chapter 3, verses 1 to 5. In each of these sections, the girl is alone at night in bed. In each of these sections, she seeks her love and wants to find him. In each of these sections, she goes out into the city. In each of these sections, she encounters watchmen. And both passages end with her referencing the daughters of Jerusalem, wanting them to essentially swear something. So let's look at this perplexing passage. And this is one of the ones that is the most difficult in the book. All right, I don't feel 100% on some of the interpretations here. And if you read commentaries on the Song of Solomon, I told you before, sometimes it feels like reading commentaries on the book of Revelation. The spectrum of views and options sometimes is just overwhelming. So we just need to let the images and the poetry stand in some cases without burdening ourselves and losing any sleep. I'm not going to lose sleep over it. I don't want you to either. In chapter 5:2, she says, "I slept, but my heart was awake." This opens with her in bed. And the question before us as interpreters is, she sleeps and her heart is awake. Does that mean she actually woke up and this is being depicted in poetic verse of this event that she went through in some fashion? Or is this a dream? And now you could see what's at stake there in terms of the interpretation. It is what we're about to read, a dream. She says, "I slept, but my heart was awake." So is that happening at the same time? Is there an alertness in some sense that she's experiencing, some kind of wakefulness, but she's really asleep with what we're about to see? Or if she starts out asleep, is she actually woken up? I'm going to lean slightly toward that, okay? I think that she is in bed, she is dreaming, and she is sort of shaken out of her stupor, and the following events happen. And she seems to be somewhat confused and even somewhat aroused, and I think the language will confirm that. So in verse 2, "I slept, but my heart was awake." The implication is that the man, the husband, is not there. But I think at this point, This is not a flashback to their courtship. The language in 5, 2, and following, I think, requires us to see them as a married couple. So the way I'm going to approach the structure of the book, from 1:1 to 2:7, and in 2:8 to 3:5, I think there were flashbacks to when they were engaged, their betrothal. And then 3:6 to 5:1, this glorious depiction of their marriage. I think once we're at that central place, the latter sections, starting in 5:2 and following, aren't flashing back to the courtship, but giving us some insight or snippets or slices of their married life. All right, so I think in 5:2 to 8:4, they're married. And I think in 8:5 through verse 14, they're married. No more flashbacks to the betrothal stage, I don't think. So she is awake, but the man is not home. And it says in verse 2, a sound, literally a voice, my beloved is knocking. So in the corresponding section from 2:8 to 3:5, she awoke and found him gone. Here, she awakes and finds him gone, but he seems to be nearby, knocking. It's pictured here as if he is trying to get her attention. And if this is late at night, in fact, it's late enough to where she would be in bed, this is odd. Why is he trying to get her attention? This would not be appropriate if they are not married, because it seems that what he is interested in is sexual intimacy, and she recognizes it as well. So the beloved is knocking, and he says, "Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one." That's a little list there of four terms, and they're quite endearing. My sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, and my locks with the drops of the night. Now, he wants her to open the door, but I think this is a metaphor to be read also on another level, like a double entendre. And I think to determine the imagery here is the end of the last section. If you'll recall, a few weeks ago, we saw in chapter 4, verse 12, that she was a garden locked until her wedding day. So she is shut up and locked. She is not going to give access until they are married to her body. And it tells us in chapter 4, 16, "Awake, north wind, and come, south wind, and blow upon my garden, and let its spices flow," which is a way of saying, let him now come and enjoy the fruits of sexual intimacy. And then in chapter 5, verse 1, he said, "I came to my garden, my sister, my bride, and gathered my myrrh and spice." And I think that's all vivid language to say that he planned and did enjoy the fruit of their intimacy as a couple. Now, what she's now being pictured as is someone who is in bed and the access is blocked in some way, locked. And he says, "Open to me." And he doesn't just mean, "Let me in." He intends for her to engage in sexual intimacy. After all, it would be odd if they were married that he couldn't get inside. I don't think we should overread this. It's not like she has the keys to the house and he just forgot his, or some other explanation. I think it is late and he is interested in intimacy. And he says, "Open to me, my sister, my love." And that's what he means. More than just open the door. He wants her to open to him. And he wants inside. His head is wet with dew, locks with the drops of the night. There's this picture of desperation. There's this picture even of exhaustion of him arriving. And he wants her. He covers here in this verse, he covers his affection with her with four terms: my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. Just a couple thoughts on these terms here. My sister and my love seem to stress the intimacy they share. It was very common for brothers and sisters to be more affectionate to one another in public in the ancient Near East than a married couple was permitted to. People sort of frowned on the idea of husbands and wives being overly affectionate with each other in the ancient Near East. And so he is saying to her, I think, with this sister language, not that she's his actual sister, but that she is someone with whom he desires to be intimate. And my sister and my love, that seems to capture their intimacy. But my dove and my perfect one, dove has been used earlier to picture her eyes and even aspects of her body in perfection. Earlier, he said in chapter 4, "In you there is no flaw," after he went down from her head as far as he could go in the book. And it still remained in the Bible. And so what we have to recognize is he seems to be here referring not just to their union, but to how he feels toward her physically. My dove, my perfect one. And he wants her to open to him. And she says in verse 3, sort of in a comical way, I think, for the reader, I had put off my garment. How could I put it on? I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them? I think this should be understood as a refusal. She is not wanting to let him in. However, we want to read that on whatever level. She is providing two statements here and two questions. The statements are, I put off my garment and I bathed my feet. And when they put off their garment to go to bed, she may be completely unclothed at this point. She's saying, how can I put my garment on again? She says, I bathed my feet. How could I soil them? So the poetry is keeping in view this idea of having to get out of bed and in some way invite him in. That language, I think, is consistent with if he is initiating or wanting sexual intimacy, this is a refusal. She is unclothed and her feet are clean and she does not want to open to him. Then in verse 4, we learn that her reluctance does not last long. My beloved put his hand to the latch and my heart was thrilled within me. This seems to be either the window or some aspect of the door where he's willing to continue to confirm his presence there. My beloved put his hand to the latch, but he doesn't force it. He's not saying, oh, no, you need to rethink this. You need to rethink this. Don't you realize who I am? Don't you realize, you know, that we're married? Don't you realize that it doesn't matter if the hour's too late? He's not forcing the issue. In fact, he is respectful. He takes her response, and it seems that while she was initially reluctant, it doesn't last because she says, my heart was now thrilled within me. Thrilled within me. Her heart earlier in verse 2 was awake, and in verse 4, her heart is thrilled. The idea of being awake in the Song of Solomon or being thrilled seems to have sexual connotations at some point in the context. And I think that's what's happening here. While she was initially reluctant, I've bathed my feet, I've taken off my garment, how could I soil my feet and put my garment on again? It's as if she rethinks this moment here. And she is thrilled, likely sexual arousal here in verse 4. I think then we should imagine that she is getting out of bed. With the way the poetry's images are inviting us to think about it. And I think that's confirmed in verse 5. I arose to open to my beloved. And my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the bolt. So as she goes to open this poetic door, so to speak, this metaphor, I think, for their relationship and their intimacy, she will find him gone, but the language of myrrh and her hands dripping with myrrh is it's an element, this spice, that's connected earlier in the book with sexual intimacy. We've seen this in chapter 1:1 to 2:7 and 2:8 to 3:5 and in the wedding scene. I think that they are, in a way, missing one another. That seems to be what's happening here. He has had desire, and it was not initially met. And now hers begins to rise, and he is gone. They seem to be missing one another. Married couples would know what this is like, right? There is a realness here that even if this is poetically expressed, there are times where desire is not simultaneously felt by both parties. And here, she rises to open to her beloved, and he's gone. And it's like her soul is just downcast because of this. She says, my soul failed me. That's pretty graphic language. And again, I don't think this is meant to be saying that she was thinking of him in an idolatrous sense and that she was in some way sinfully despondent or anxious. I think she's truly overcome with a sense of regret. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. So we should see here that there is a separation. Okay, there is this parting of sorts poetically, and we don't know how much to read into this historically. We don't know if Solomon or this bride would have had this exact historical thing play out, but at least poetically to this point, their relationship is being depicted as, okay, there can be times where in the relationship there is some kind of tension or conflict, some miscommunication. And this is very true to life for marriages. We know what this is like as well. When verse 6, I opened to my beloved had gone, my soul failed me when he spoke, I sought him but found him not, I called to him but he gave no answer. So here she seems to leave. Notice what's happening in verse 7, and this is what's so bizarre. It's one of the most disconcerting and dark moments in the song. The watchman found me as they went about in the city. They beat me. They bruised me. They took away my veil, those watchmen of the walls. And here, the reader would rightfully say, wait, what? What did we just read? In chapter 3, 1-5, we saw her encounter those watchmen, and she was wanting to seek her beloved, and they did not know where he was. They did not provide her any help, but they in no way harmed her. Here, she encounters these same watchmen, and they seem to be guarding the city walls. That's what they would. They were watchmen of the walls at the end of verse 7, and they're going about the city streets. We should imagine them as a kind of patrol in the streets, a patrol that is wanting to keep guard on things and people. And one of the things that the patrolmen and other ancient Near Eastern territories would keep a view on is any unsavory and salacious activity at night. And one of the things that this woman was concerned about earlier in chapter 1, verse 7, is that she would be mistaken as a prostitute in the flocks of her beloved's companions. So in chapter 1, 7, she says, "Tell me, you whom my soul loves, where you pasture your flock, where you make it lie down at noon. For why should I be like one who veils herself beside the flocks of your companions?" One of the things that would happen is prostitutes would take advantage of flocks whose shepherds were resting and taking a respite during the day, and the prostitutes would seek to use that as an opportunity to make money. And here, it's as if she's mistaken as that in the city. So she's got this veil on. She's wandering around the streets in the night. I mean, surely no good's going to come from this. And so when they see her, they do what many ancient Near Eastern patrols would do to any sort of unsanctioned activity, and they would bring punishment. And again, I don't know how far to read this language. She could just be describing a dream. Haven't you ever had weird dreams? Maybe even last night? I mean, strange things that don't make sense when you think about them. And you think, why did this person show up in this dream and this place? And all the mixture of relationships and worlds and circles that we're in that come together. Dreams can be so odd with the way that they turn out. Maybe that's what she's experiencing here. It's hard to tell for sure. And so the watchmen find her, though. They beat her, they bruise her, they took away her veil, those watchmen of the walls. They seem to be thinking that they're doing the right thing. And the reader knows at this moment that they are wrong, at least in what they might assume of her. She's no prostitute. She would be the king's bride. And if we were to read this as literally as or historically as possible, anyone who did this to the king's bride, heads are going to roll. So I guess what I'm saying is it's unclear whether this would actually be realistic. Would the king's bride at some point go walking through the streets of Jerusalem and attacked by the patrolmen? It seems unlikely to me. Whatever is being poetically described here, I'm hesitant to say it was because of an actual historical happening to this woman. In verse 8, though, she speaks to the daughters of Jerusalem, and they are going to have a dialogue with her for the rest of the book. For the rest of our section tonight. "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him I am sick with love." Now notice, she's sick with love, not sick of love. Okay, she's not sick of him. She's sick with love. In other words, she's weakened by it. She needs to be remedied. And he's got what she needs. That's I think what's the point is. I mean, the remedy that she is sick with love. I need him. That's what she wants. And so she's telling these daughters of Jerusalem, "If you find my beloved, tell him I'm sick with love." Now, why in the world are they there? These daughters of Jerusalem, why are they wandering around the streets at night, you know? And again, I think this invites the reader to remember we're reading lyrics of a song. This is poetic. I don't think we should overread these to say, yeah, there was this group of women known as the daughters of Jerusalem, and they were just out in the street sometime, and in the life of this bride, she happened to come upon them one time. No, I think that these are supporting roles in the song in order to move the narrative along, or at least what's being depicted. She wants their help. So here's the first question or questions in verse 9. Questions from the daughters of Jerusalem. They say to her, "What is your beloved more than another beloved, O most beautiful among women? What is your beloved more than another beloved that you thus adjure us?" So notice what this woman has been through. She's left the safety of her home, wandering around the streets in the ancient Near East for a woman at night. That's a dangerous thing to do. Love is making her make even irrational leaps, it seems. Love is making her do crazy things. You might know what that's like. So it doesn't even make sense, perhaps, as the reader. Why didn't she just wait till the morning? I mean, he knows where she lives. Surely he'll come back to that window or that door and knock again. She just leaves in the middle of the night? What is happening? And so they want to know, what is so special about this man? That's a legitimate question. They say to her, what is your beloved more than another? O most beautiful among women, what's your beloved more than another that you thus adjure us? What's so special about this guy that you're so lovesick? Okay, so here's her answer. She's going to explain to them what she sees in him. Now, this doesn't mean everybody else who looks at him will see what she sees in him, but it's important that we understand that in the eyes of this bride, her husband is set apart. And this is what we should pray for the Lord to cultivate in our hearts toward our spouse, a sense of their distinction among all the others that are in the world. The Lord has gifted us with our spouse, and he or she is going to answer their question. What's so special about him? Well, here we go. In verse 10, my beloved is radiant and ruddy, which means he is glowing, shining, and this ruddiness has this kind of color, it seems, this healthy color. He's not like, ghostly looking to where you'd say, are you feeling okay? Are you about to pass out? You know, all the color is just drained from your face. I think this is a way of saying he looks good to me. She's saying he is radiant and ruddy. Interesting. David was described as ruddy in 1 Samuel 16:12, and as well as a handsome man. And here the son of David is being described by his bride as radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. So here, what's remarkable, I think, is if you were to line up, I think with the image here, 10,000 men, she says, I would spot mine because I love him. I want him. There's no confusion. I know the one for me. And so she says he's radiant and ruddy. I don't actually think Solomon glowed, right? I mean, again, this is poetry. It's meant to say in her eyes, he is a shining man. And guys, we want to care and love our wives in such a way that there would be a radiance that they would discern in our treatment and words toward them. She's able to discern that. The way he cares for her and the way he loves her leads her to respond in this way. So guys, would we love our wives in such a way that she would say this kind of thing? That's a goal. That's something to pursue and to prayerfully cultivate. I don't think she's making this up. I think she really feels this way. My beloved is radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. Then she's going to start with his head and go down. In verse 11, his head is the finest gold. His locks are wavy, black as a raven. And so this is a way of saying, you know, when I'm face to face with him, his head, his hair, the way when I'm looking at him, I like what I see. He's magnificent. In verse 12, his eyes, talked about his hair, his eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk, sitting beside a full pool. That's a mouthful right there of imagery, right? Doves, this is gentle, it pictures this tranquil setting. These doves are there by water. I mean, you just watch birds sitting by water sometimes. Our backyard's full of this kind of life all the time. Whenever it rains, there's a little spot of our backyard that tends to gain more water than other parts of the yard. And these birds love that spot. They will go toward the back and they'll splash around it. They'll sit by it. And it is peaceful. When you watch that and you catch yourself realizing, I've been watching these birds for 5 minutes. I didn't even realize that time passed. It's such a tranquil and peaceful thing. And he makes her feel at peace and tranquil. His eyes, when she looks at him, it's a good thing and a welcoming thing and a calming thing. He's not a source of provocation for her. It's peaceful with him. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk, sitting beside a full pool. It makes you want to go and enjoy that kind of sight right now. You know, it's that kind of thing where, yes, I want to be there. She wants to be with him. She can't wait till he's gone. She wants to be with him because being with him is like this. In verse 13, his cheeks are like beds of spices, mounds of sweet-smelling herbs. His lips are lilies dripping with liquid myrrh. All right, so I think this is all a way of speaking about his mouth and what surrounds his mouth. And I think the similes here, the cheeks like spices or his lips are lilies and dripping with myrrh, I think this is a way of saying his kisses. And each time the bride and the groom are engaged in this kind of kissing in the book, it is always in marriage. And a few weeks ago, I suggested to you that prior to the covenant of marriage, this kind of activity that you see this bride and groom engaging in can only be described as something in the context of lust and a lack of self-control. And in the covenant of marriage, it is appropriate and commended in the book. And so we want to be careful, not just with boundaries in addition to kissing in a relationship, though that is certainly a category, but even kissing itself is a gateway to all sorts of other things. There is a reason why deep and prolonged kissing fills people's minds with such a fogginess that they're not even thinking clearly, and one thing can lead to another. And so there are measures of self-control that are exhorted to these daughters of Jerusalem, that they not awaken love until it pleases. And here, she seems to be describing him in a way, because love has been awakened and she has enjoyed him. His lips are lilies dripping with liquid myrrh. She enjoys not just looking at him, but physical intimacy with him, kissing him. It is sweet to her, and it smells good. In verse 14, his arms are rods of gold set with jewels. And so as she is moving down his body here, she is speaking of his arms as something beautiful and set with jewels. The picture here almost calls to mind, doesn't it, like architecture. So when I think of rods of gold and later the ivory and verse 15, his legs are alabaster columns. You sort of think of these like solid structures, these things that have been sculpted and chipped away at in the ancient world to make them a beautiful and an eye-catching thing. So he's an eye-catching person in her mind, and she's depicting him with these solid, firm, awesome to behold things. And the imagery is meant to dazzle us. She goes on to say his body is polished ivory, bedecked with sapphires. And I think that's meant to be the same thing. When she's thinking about his anatomy, and some of this, depending on the interpreter that you read in commentaries, could actually be quite explicit if she continues to move down his body. In verse 15, she moves to his legs. His legs are alabaster columns set on bases of gold. Again, structural imagery seemed to be used. Gold was used in association with his head earlier on, and now at the bottom of his body with his legs are set on bases of gold. His appearance, if she were to zoom out the camera for a moment there, she's been, you know, zooming in, and she's just been taking us through the journey going down with the camera. Now she's widening out the view, and she said, his appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. These elements like gold and these jewels and cedars were used to construct not just the king's palace in 1 Kings, but the temple itself. She is depicting him in temple-like language. His mouth, she says in verse 16, is most sweet, and he is altogether desirable. He's sweet as if he's a tree providing fruit that she enjoys feasting upon. In chapter 2, verse 3, for instance, she says, an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my young man with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. I think she is comparing him here to the cedars of Lebanon or fruitful trees here in chapter 5:16, and he is sweet to her taste. So here we saw in chapter 5, verse 9, they said to her, these daughters of Jerusalem, what is your beloved more than another beloved? And she describes him in ways that set him apart. And it's as if they say, okay, we get it. All right, we understand. This is what you see in him. I mean, clearly, he's distinct in your eyes. We might not say the same thing, but there he is in your eyes. Chapter 6, 1, here are their next questions. Where has your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Where has your beloved turned that we may seek him with you? So they want to help facilitate the reunion. There is this separation. There is in some way a distance that's been caused. And they want to be an aid and a help to this. And they want to know, where has he gone, O most beautiful among women? Where has your beloved turned that we may seek him with you? Now, they don't mean it selfishly, I don't think at all, not to imply in any way we want to seek him to have him for ourselves. We want to seek him with you, for you. That's the idea. They want to aid this most beautiful among women, they say in chapter 6:1. So their first sets of questions, what is your beloved more than another one? And then in chapter 6:1, well, where has he gone now, this beloved that you're after? Now, her answer in verses 2 and 3 seems to imply a kind of reunion. I think that given the garden and spice and language that we've seen earlier, what she's about to say speaks of him now with her. And this makes sense because, as we'll see next week, he begins to speak in chapter 6, verse 4. So this separation that these daughters of Jerusalem are invited in on to consider and to in some way question her and receive answers from her about, this beloved is now there. This is why we have to think about this as poetry. We don't know how much time had passed. We don't know how much historically we should read into this. But all of a sudden, he was not there. And now she says suddenly in chapter 6, 2, my beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to graze in the gardens and gather the lilies. Well, earlier, just in the very previous section of chapter 3, 6 to 5, 1, going to the garden and the beds of spices and grazing and gathering lilies was all sexual language. It was a reference to her body and his. In fact, she was spoken of as a garden that was locked. And so she's saying, my beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to graze in the gardens and gather lilies together. And I think what's being said here then is the reunion has happened. The bypassing one another and the miscommunication and any tension that was there has been resolved. And so she's using, I think, sexually charged language, not because it's as evident here in chapter 6, 2, but because previous sections of the book have prepared us for it. I'll give you an example in chapter 2, 16. In chapter 2, 16, my beloved is mine and I am his. He grazes among the lilies until the day breeze and the shadows flee. Be like a gazelle or a stag on the cleft mountains. Well, when she's declaring that she's his and he's hers and he's grazing among lilies and she wants him to be a gazelle on the mountains, they don't mean any of that about literal lilies or literal mountains. That's all nature imagery and animal imagery and fruit imagery to describe, or flower imagery, excuse me, to describe their sexual intimacy. The same thing in chapter 5, verse 1. I came to my garden, he says, my sister, my bride. I gathered my myrrh and my spice, and I ate my honeycomb with my honey. I drank my wine with my milk. And I think all of that is meant to say, I enjoyed the intimacy in marriage with my bride. So here, in chapter 6, 2, I could go on and on with other examples, but hopefully this suffices to say, I think this is sexually charged language where she says he has now come to his garden and he is grazing and gathering lilies. It's another way of saying he's with me. Where has he gone? All of a sudden he's here. And she declares it in chapter 6, verse 3. I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine and he grazes among the lilies. This is covenantal language. God has joined them together. And they can rightly say of one another, you are mine and I am yours. We are each other's in this relationship. And that last phrase there, he grazes among the lilies, I think is another way of speaking about their enjoyment of their one flesh union physically. God has brought them together. Her soul longs for him. Her body longs for him. And they are united at every level. That's the impression you get in the Song of Solomon. It is Edenic. It is beautiful. It is glorious. And they are unashamed. The language is graphic. And it will continue to be in the remainder of this section. But they are unashamed and overcome the tension in their relationship. I would like us to consider for a moment, as we think about our last few minutes together, as we zoom out and see the separation that was brought about, and then the miscommunication and the bypassing of one another in terms of their desire, their longing to be back together, and their final reunion here, and even the way she speaks about him, there are things we should consider. They were not content with their tension to be the way it was. And we should consider that tension in a relationship is a ministry opportunity. Because tension in this marriage, in chapter 5, 2 and following, is resolved. It's not something that they want to plant and let that grow out of roots of bitterness in the relationship. They want to address and overcome. In fact, when they say to the woman, what is your beloved more than another beloved? Even though there was a misstep, and even though there was something he wanted and she was refusing, and then she had desire, and then he was gone, and they're trying to catch one another once more, the way she speaks of him is uplifting and encouraging. And I think we should consider that spouses should not run one another into the ground to other people. That even the way the spouses speak to one another here, it's not because everything is perfect. I mean, obviously, they're not back in paradise, but it is a remnant of Eden that we are feasting upon with our eyes and our ears. And we are seeing that their tension is an opportunity for them to make peace and resolution and reconciliation. They're coming together. And in chapter 6:4, we're going to see him talk to her and she's going to respond. And he's going to speak again in chapter 7 and she's going to respond at the end of 7 and into chapter 8. And so their back and forth will continue. And they want to speak to one another in ways that are uplifting and encouraging. When we think of Paul's words in Ephesians 4, that we not let any unwholesome talk come out of our mouths, we should consider that a declaration also to husbands and to wives for one another. That we want to speak to one another in edifying and wholesome ways. And so if you are in habits of speaking to your husband or your wife in ways that are degrading and belittling, or to other people about your spouse that are belittling and degrading, you should repent. And you should see the beauty and the glory of the Song of Solomon, and you should say, that is what I want from my heart toward my spouse, and that's what I want to pray for the Lord to make in their heart toward me. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. Tension in a relationship is a ministry opportunity. It's going to happen. And if it hasn't happened yet today, it may happen tomorrow or later in the week. Something's going to happen, and there will be misunderstanding and miscommunication and some sort of conflict, and those are opportunities for peacemaking, forgiveness, and patience. Tension in a relationship is a ministry opportunity. It's a way for you to walk by the Spirit and to care for someone else who is different from you. All of our husbands and wives are different from us. And some of them might be very different. We might even say that we're just opposites in so many ways. No differences in personality, no difference in background ever justifies treating one another sinfully. We're called to walk by the Spirit. And despite our differences, we should see these tensions as moments of opportunity for ministering to this other person. When someone sins against me or someone sins against you, we should see those as opportunities for us to exercise the grace of forgiveness toward that person and to not hold grudge against them or to grow embittered toward them. When our relationship and marriage is in some way harmed or disrupted by conflict, we should see those as now we have an opportunity for peacemaking. And now we have an opportunity to show ourselves to be sons and daughters of God. Blessed are the peacemakers, Jesus says. Don't you want blessing to revive and renew your marriage? One of the ways to consider how that blessing will roll out is how you can contribute toward it. Forgiveness and peacemaking and patience. The reason we need to be prepared to show patience towards someone else is because we're going to need it ourselves. We're going to need someone to show patience toward me. I need my wife to show patience toward me and kindness toward me. And so I need to have already tilled that ground by showing patience and kindness toward her. Tension in a relationship is opportunities for us to walk by the Spirit. I'm not saying real wrong hasn't happened. I'm not saying there might not be a real legitimate problem and that even someone within the marriage may not be able to simply solve themselves and maybe even need help and counsel outside of that. So some issues and tensions within marriage can be deep and broad and so they don't all look alike, right? But there is this resolve that she has. I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. That union warrants something from them. And our joining together in marriage calls from us forgiveness and peacemaking and patience and kindness and self-control and all the rest. It calls us to watch our words. The way they speak to one another in the Song of Solomon is another instructive and exemplary thing. And so I'm not sure, you know, which aspect of the Song of Solomon's passage tonight stood out to you or which of these applications would be most relevant to you tonight. But when we think of Christ, who is the Son of David, to which Solomon points, he is the only one who truly measures up. You might look at the description that she has of him and some of the ones that he has of her, and you might say, well, that just feels too good to be true. I mean, nobody is that great. Because we're sinners, right? There are Edenic elements to this, but this is why ultimately this is a type of Christ. Only Christ measures up. And if we are looking in someone else what only Christ provides, or if we in some way are seeking to earn our way to be accepted and forgiven by God by the way we want to treat one another on some sort of moral high ground, then we need to consider the glory of the Song of Solomon in light of the redemptive story. Christ is the only one who measures up. As husbands and wives, we don't compare to the Son of David who loved us and gave himself for us. And that is the best news, because it's gospel truth and gospel nourishment that should stir within us conviction and commitment to love Christ and one another better. What neighbor do we have more closely to us than our spouse? You know, someone with whom we share a bed, and day after day, one meal after another, or conversations and opportunities and heartaches and blessings and losses. We share so much with our spouses. They're our closest neighbor. We're called to love our neighbors as ourselves. And there are occasions where I think our familiarity and relationship with one another can cause us to be so comfortable and so secure in our relationships that we can justify acting and speaking in ways toward one another that we would never want to be seen doing by anyone else, or even want to be caught doing, or even feel justified in doing towards someone else. But we can think, well, you know, they're my spouse. They're used to it, or we're accustomed to it. They can take it. Let's raise the bar. Let's not say, how low can we set things that we can most tolerate? Let's outdo one another in serving one another in love. Let's seek to show one another honor and edify and encourage one another with our words. Let's, with our speech and with our actions, so demonstrate the love of Christ toward our spouse that they will want to respond to us in the ways that these spouses are speaking and responding to one another. Christ is the only one who measures up. He ultimately is our tabernacle and our temple, the presence of God among us. And Jesus Christ is the one to whom marriage points. When we consider the glorious gift that is marriage, that's a temporal, earthly reality, isn't it? Pointing forward to that one day when Christ will return and the bride will descend, according to Revelation 21, like a bride prepared for her husband. And that gospel story will have reached its culmination. But let in the meantime our hearts be dependent upon the Lord for us to tell that story in a micro way. I didn't say microwave, a micro way, lest I be misunderstood, podcast mic. A micro way, a mini parable of a larger cosmic reality. We have the privilege in this world to know in the Bible what marriage is for. It's not just some human invention. It was designed by God for his glory to point toward the husband and bride relationship of Christ and his church. We have the amazing privilege of ministry opportunities over and over again in our marriages to show forgiveness and kindness and grace and patience and love and self-control and on and on, because Christ has shown all of that and more to us. I think we should see in the Song of Solomon, we should desire to be Christ-like.